What I'm going to talk about today is how to integrate out the high energy scale exactly in the Hubbard model. And the key message in today's talk is that there are two distinct charge E excitations in the low energy theory of a dope mott insulator. I'm going to try and tell you what I think, what physics these, how this plays out in the physics of the cuprates, for example. This work was done in collaboration with my student Ting-Pong Choi, who is right there. He's a graduate fellow here for this semester, and Rob Lee, who some of you might not know, but he was a student of Joe Polchinski's. He's now one of my colleagues at Illinois, and we worked on how to perform this integration. Okay, so the background. Yeah. He's Mr. D-Brains.
Oh.
That was his project with Joe, and Joe's here because he knows that I did this work with Rob, and he's a very, very smart guy. And yeah, he's just okay. So the background for the problem is, of course, the cuprates. And my approach to this problem is to kind of answer to. Focus on what I think is the zeroth order problem. How do you think about the normal state? And I think the key question that arises is, what are the charge degrees of freedom? And can you somehow span this boundary right here, if in the sense that it seems as if the pseudo gap is arising out of the strange metal phase? And since it's all part of the normal phase of the cuprates, it makes sense then to ask the question, can you actually come up with a theory that allows you to span this boundary? Okay, my approach is to focus on what I think is the simplest model that captures the physics of a dope mott insulator and construct a proper low energy theory of it. And in so doing, I will have isolated the relevant degrees of freedom insofar as this problem can be attributed to a Hubbard model, for example. Okay, now the key physics which complicates this problem is actually spectral wave transfer. All right, and I'll tell you exactly what I mean by that. Okay, to put everyone on the same map, and since Joe is here, let me just remind you what the Mott problem is. The Mott problem was nickel oxide. And nickel oxide is a half-filled band, but nonetheless it insulated. And a way of understanding how it is that nickel oxide insulates is to consider the floor plan for station Q. It doesn't take long after being there once to realize that this is the floor plan. They have n theorists in n rooms.
You're one-dimensional, though.
Yeah, you are one-dimensional. I realize this wasn't this wasn't a realistic. Okay. So the important thing is that if you were to put two of these theorists in the same room, it would cost a huge amount of energy. And Mott realized a long time ago that this is essential in answering the question of why it is a half-filled band, in fact insulates as opposed to exhibiting standard metallic conductivity. Their internal degrees of freedom I wasn't able to discern in my one visit there. Okay, so the problem that you have to construct a low energy theory for then is a half-filled system in which a charge gap is dynamically generated, and ostensibly you have a lower band and an upper band, and the precise meanings of these I'm going to talk about, because this is crucial in understanding how to integrate out the high energy scale. But that's the basic problem that one is faced with. Okay, now of course there is a simple way of doing this problem. Simply order all the eigenstates of the Hubbard model and say they fall into this sort of pattern. Throw away the all of them except the lowest one, and you look at this eigenstate will be a linear combination of all of the atomic states, including double occupancy. And the problem is you only really do this for small systems, and you really don't even learn a lot even for small systems, so this is clearly not the approach to the problem. Okay, what you would like to do is do what we do in field theory. Namely, you have some action for the problem. It's in terms of some field. You divide this field into a low energy and a high energy part, and you perform an integration. You explicitly integrate out the degrees of freedom far away from the chemical potential. Okay, and it's that integration that I want to show you how to do for the Hubbard model. And that should be the low energy theory, which should have, insofar as the cooperates are described by a Hubbard model, that should describe, I think, the normal state of the problem. Okay, so consider the cooperates then. For whole doping, what you have to do is integrate out the upper Hubbard band. And in the case of electron doping, it's this degree of freedom which is now far away from where the chemical potential now lies in the upper Hubbard band. Okay, so the goal then is to identify a field that allows us to carry out this integration. Okay, now this is just really somewhat, well, let me just put this in here anyway. The cooperates were discovered here, and I think this is the correct starting point for looking at this problem. So the question I ask is, after 20 years, has the high energy scale been integrated out? The answer is no. Okay, and there are two problems that one encounters. Okay, anytime you perform an integration in some field theory, you're either doing a bosonic path integral or a fermionic path integral. And if you look at the physics at the high energy scale, you simply look at the energy scale U, that's the largest scale in the problem, you can't really rewrite these degrees of freedom in terms of something which is purely bosonic or purely fermionic. You can certainly write this in a quadratic form, but it's in terms of operators, these Hubbard operators, which don't obey standard bosonic or fermionic commutation relations. The second problem, and it's a symptom of this problem, is that there is spectral wave transfer between the upper Hubbard band and the lower Hubbard band. And it's coming from the fact that these degrees of freedom, unlike the band insulator case where the conduction band and the valence band do form, are in fact the eigenstates, these are really not eigenstates of the Hubbard Hamiltonian. And that manifests itself in the following. If you write an electron operator as a linear combination of something which is moving on sites which are empty and this on sites which have something on it, the reason why I've isolated these operators in this fashion is that this roughly describes the physics in the upper Hubbard band, and hence it's the physics of essentially double occupancy, and this is essentially the physics now of the lower Hubbard band. But as I said, these are not eigenstates of the Hubbard Hamiltonian, and hence there is mixing between these two degrees of freedom. You can't even really call them degrees of freedom, okay, because that implies a certain sort of technical definition, which in fact they are not. Now, this has a profound manifestation if in fact these things mix. You should be able to see this mixing by carrying out any sort of spectroscopy. Okay, now here's a very simple way of understanding what kind of mixing results, and this argument is due to a beautiful paper by George Sawatsky. Okay, so consider a Mott insulator where you have one electron per site. Okay, and I want to ask two very simple questions. How many ways are there of removing an electron? And that's what you do in photoemission. There are n electrons, there are n ways of doing that. And how many ways are there of adding an electron to the system? That's what you would do if, for example, you could do inverse photoemission. There are also n ways of doing that. Okay? And I don't care about, once I have n electrons present, the spins are irrelevant, although they're certainly important in obtaining this gap between putting an electron in the system and removing an electron from the system. Okay, so there are n So the Hilberts, the total Hilbert space then for adding an electron, removing an electron is equal, it's equal to n. Okay, now what I want to do is redo this argument when I remove an electron from the system. Now if this were a band insulator, removing an electron from the valence band would affect nothing about the degrees of freedom that are in the conduction band. But in this case, that's not true. If you now remove an electron here, and let's redo this counting argument of George, you ask the question, how many ways would they remove an electron? Well, they're only n minus 1, so they're n minus 1. This has now been reduced by 1. But now let's ask the second question. How many ways are there of removing an of adding an electron so that it costs an energy u? Well, there are only n minus 1 places in which you can get double occupancy, which means the spectral weight in this upper Hubbard band, which could technically be infinitely far away, has also gone down by 1. So you add up the states, there are 2 less states. Those 2 less states can't have just vanished, they have to go somewhere. Okay, they correspond to the 2 ways of adding an electron to this site with either spin up or spin down. Which means, at the end of the day, what you've done is you've transferred 1 state, and it doesn't cost any energy to do that. So these have to be part of the addition part of the low-energy spectral weight. So you can divide the low-energy spectral weight into an electron removal part, which has weight n minus 1, and an electron addition part, which has weight 2.
Is this the spectral weight of the electron?
So this question, right, yeah. So the thought experiment, right. No, it's entirely in terms of the electron spectral function. So this has a well-defined meaning in terms of the single particle Green function for this problem. Okay. Okay, so if you were to add x holes, what you would find is this weight is 2x. And in fact, George has shown that in general, the weight here, if you now, so this argument I've shown you, this 2x argument, and I refer to it as the 2x sum rule, that's entirely due to George Sawatsky. This is exact in the atomic limit. If you turn on hopping, you find that in fact this weight has a dynamical part which is greater than 2x. So the 2x is kind of the lower bound, and any hopping in fact increases the weight which is transferred between increases the communication or the lack of orthogonality between the upper and the lower Hubbard bands. Okay, so what this says is that when you dope the system, one state, x states are transferred here, x states are transferred down here, which means some of the low energy degrees of freedom are derived from this high energy scale. Okay, this is UV-IR mixing, and that's.
How can one distinguish the n minus 1, the lower Hubbard band, from this 2?
Very easily. The chemical potential shifts downwards, okay, and those are the states. So then, what you would do is you would integrate from the chemical potential up to some mid-infrared energy, and you'd find that this weight is in fact 2x. Below the chemical potential, this weight is 1 minus x. So the chemical potential does shift downwards as you dope the system, and you would be looking at the weight at an intermediate energy range, and that would be governed by this counting argument of George. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so you're using the chemical potential.
Right. You're right.
It's a result of what? This conclusion results from what? Is that a calculation, or is that...
This is exact for... The atomic limit, it's exact. There's no... No. I mean, just go and look at the Hubbard model in the atomic limit. This is the exact counting argument. And it's very different from the counting argument in a band insulator, in which nothing changes in the upper Hubbard band, in the upper band. And what then you can do is ask the question, how robust is this? Okay, and you can turn on T, the hopping, and you find that, in fact, this is very robust, and all conclusions seem to indicate this weight has a dynamical part, which is greater than, which it gives you a total weight from here, which is in fact greater than 2x. So the UV-IR mixing is something fundamental, For example, if you just go and calculate a sum rule on the single particle spectral function, and you do this perturbatively, you find that the leading term, this was done by Lang and Harris back in 58 actually, the leading term is a correction in T, and it's positive.
Sorry, something went by too bad. You're mentioning that non-orthogonality of something with something that I didn't quite
know. Right. This, you wouldn't have spectral wave transfer between the upper and the lower Hubbard band if these degrees of freedom were in fact orthogonal to one another.
Yes, yeah, so you said something about not wanting to use the term degrees of freedom, which confused me, and now
okay.
You're using it again. So
okay, sorry. If these bands, let me just use bands. Degrees of freedom, I think, come out from diagonalizing a Hamiltonian. So.
Right. Exactly. I mean, so if you're talking about energy eigenspaces.
Yeah. No. Right? Yeah. I know. That's not the case here.
Me.
These are not energy eigenstates of the Hubbard model. Okay. That's the key thing. Upper and lower Hubbard bands are not energy eigenstates.
I mean, if it's free fermions, the spectral function, and the density of single particle states.
Right.
The density of states.
Right.
I guess is the.
No, but I mean, but a spectral function means it's the amplitude that you create an eigenstate of that energy when you act with that operator, right? So, I mean, isn't that what a spectral function means? So, how can you say that you're not talking about eigenstates?
I'm not talking about certainly, when you do that, you are talking about eigenstates. But this separation into an upper Hubbard band and a lower Hubbard band, these are not the eigenstates of the system.
Then I don't know what you mean by spectral function. I think a spectral function, take a green element, you insert a complete set of states in between, and then you compute some matrix elements, and it's the amplitude that you're in a certain eigenstate.
But,
right? I mean,
but those are not equal to what gives you the upper Hubbard band.
For non-interacting electrons, only one intermediate state would contribute.
For non-interacting, absolutely.
Yeah,
one
so I think as soon as you have interactions, then...
That's why it's a whole... Right, that's
it's a function, right? Interaction there,
okay. That's fine, but I don't understand this non-orthogonality statement, okay.
Yeah. If you identify the upper Hubbard band as physics associated with double occupancy, the moment you turn on T, that is not an eigenstate of the Hubbard model.
I understand, but there are some eigenstates. Which
there are some
in the Green's function, which are you may want to. The Green's function will show you that there's some amplitude to be in those eigenstates if you act with a single particle creation operator, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, okay, so, but that's not what the upper and lower Hubbard bands are telling you.
So what are
maybe you need to define by lower and upper Hubbard bands.
No, but, okay, so.
You're right, I mean, that's what.
Are you going to use this word orthogonal? I mean.
No, I'm not. I'm just setting up the problem. I'm just setting up the problem, okay? Okay, I'm setting up the problem that if you were to identify something with the high energy scale, the number of degrees of freedom that you identify here would come from this high energy scale.
But this dynamic. I don't think you use degrees of freedom either.
Well, yeah, degrees of, shit, okay, sorry.
The spectral weight.
It's better to talk about spectral weight.
But then the question is, if the spectral weight transfer is, you're gonna argue it's gonna be 2x, there's probably some coefficient because the spectral weight may be renormalized, right? So.
Well, the important thing is that removing an electron generates at least two removal states in the system at low energy.
Well, you're not saying that they're states.
Actually,
spectral weight, right? So you're arguing between x and 2x.
Yes, the argument is entirely between x and 2x. If it were x. Then one state from the valence band would just be pushed up. Okay? If it's greater than 2, I mean if it's 2 or greater, then that's something non-trivial. And
your statement is whether it's x or 2x.
My statement is not even Look, it's clearly greater than 2x, so there's no argument here.
Where does the greater than come from?
Well, I think that was the...
When you turn on the hopping.
Why is it strictly greater?
I'll let George answer that question.
That was, to me, the surprising thing, because I would have expected, well, if you turn on lots of hopping, you're generally, you know, in the end, you'll get to a simple one-particle problem, and it should go back to a single electron removal would free up one fermion state and not two. This one here, look, it's removing one electron from the system frees up two states to add an electron on the low energy scale. That's what he's saying. And as you add that hopping integral, then that becomes even larger. And that has to do with the phase of the wave function of the mixing between the low energy scale and the high energy scale, the T squared over U in the perturbative limit. And if you look at the phase of that wave function and your one particle Green's function, you find that the amplitude is increased on the low energy scale and is decreased for the upper Hubbard band. So the upper Hubbard band is a dope. Its amplitude goes to zero, basically. It doesn't move in energy. Its amplitude goes to zero. And it even goes faster to zero because of this dynamic part. And that just comes from exact diagonalization. But it's also...
But you can also get it from doing perturbation theory, which you've done. And actually, the first people to do this were Lang and Harris. Have the Harris criterion, actually. Okay, so the question I want to ask is, given that there's this mixing between the high and the low energy, how do you preserve this 2x sum rule? Okay, so there are essentially two ways of doing this, okay? One is that you can do this if you change the statistics of the particles at low energy, and that's the standard, and that's really the standard approach. If you simply order the atomic states in the system and you simply remove those by doing projection because you think that's the high energy physics in the problem, what you'll be doing is defining a set of excitations such that if you were to put two of these on the same site, that would be forbidden. So by changing the statistics in this way, putting a particle here blocks two states. Okay?
Let me ask you another question back about this sum rule. This is almost what I asked you a couple of days ago. But initially, before you turn on hopping, all these excitations in the lower Hubbard bands, the spectral waves, it's a delta function at a certain frequency. When you turn on hopping, it gets smeared out on a scale that's T.
Right.
Now, if you carry on some integration out of high energy degrees of freedom, not just to integrate out the upper Hubbard band, but you then start even looking at a scale that's smaller than T.
Right.
Does the sum rule tell me anything about what I should expect on that scale, what I expect very close to the Fermi energy?
Right. So in other words, is there a discontinuity between omega zero minus and zero plus? I don't know.
These arguments were all done on the basis of integrations where in a system where U is relatively large, so even though you have these incoherent contributions to the one particle spectral function in the electron addition part, which would enter into that gap region, right, you could still define a well-defined energy range above which there would be no spectral wave except for the upper Hubbard band. And then you can do this. As soon as you ask the question, what really happens right at the chemical potential, I don't know.
And did you do some diagonalization?
Well, the problem is you can't system big enough.
Yeah.
But you do see very strange things as you make your system bigger and bigger, I can tell what they are later on. But so it is an interesting, very interesting question.
Okay. So this is the standard procedure, and so in other words, each of these excitations is blocking two states, okay? And the 2x sum rule is actually exact if you go and follow the following procedure. You You define your effective Hamiltonian via a canonical transformation that connects sectors which differ by one double occupancy, and then you project into the space in which you prohibit double occupancy. And then you define operators, which are these projected quantities, and the model which results is the standard TJ model, and these are also in terms of those projected operators. And you trivially satisfy the 2x sum rule. You can show exactly the 2x sum rule is exact for the TJ model precisely because you've changed the statistics of your particles. Okay, now there's a problem with this TJ model at half filling, namely that to any order, if in fact you restrict yourself to one electron per site, the only terms which will come in here at any order are just spin type terms, which means they'll all have a local SU2 symmetry. Each point in space will transform independently under an SU2 transformation. This symmetry was not in the original Hubbard model. Okay, this was pointed out a long time ago by Affleck and Anderson, and also by Fradkin, Dagoto, and Morino, or someone like that. So then the question was, where did this local symmetry come from? The Hubbard model has a global SU2 symmetry. This is a higher symmetry. And the problem, so if in fact, now it's okay if symmetries emerge when you construct a low energy theory, but it has to be from some rather non-trivial reason, and certainly there's none in here that is given. Yes.
I mean, the spin model is only global SU2 spins. The local symmetry you refer to is some slave particle representation.
No, if you can write this like this, each one transforms.
The local one
is if you insist on writing S is F dagger sigma F, and then there is a redundancy in that. That's the local SU2 symmetry which Affleck and others. That's the gauge symmetry of the slave particle representation.
And so are you saying, Bill, that the TJ model what is the local SU2 symmetry of the TJ model, I guess?
Okay. A local SU2 symmetry is you left multiply by an SU2 matrix. Okay?
That local SU2 symmetry is not transformation of spins, it's transformation of slave particles.
What's H?
S is...
H is just an SU2 matrix.
Which SU2 matrix?
Just one that has to do with just a rotation.
As a free matrix. S is a vector here, isn't it?
Let me. Let me see here.
Are you
going to
use this local SU2?
No, I'm going to use this local SU2. But what you're saying is not exactly true. That symmetry that they wrote down is independent of any slave description. Because certainly Marino and Fradkin didn't use that representation.
Anyway, let's
go on. Okay, so if you're...
Your J there is the same, right? I mean, you cannot absorb the rotation into a JIJ, right?
Right, right, right. No, it's an independent of I and J.
I think the SU2, the local SU2 signature we have talked about is not the SU2 for the spin rotation. It's the SU2 for the internal well-being of the electron operator. It means that when we rotate the electron operator on a single side, the spin up and spin down electron operator rotated, we can recite the same spin. The SR, we can get the same speed operator.
Yeah, that's a particle hole transformation, actually.
In some sense, yes.
Yeah.
That's so the local SU2 signature you talk about.
You can have a discrete or continuum versions, and that's the SU2.
Yeah,
but that's different from the Eisenberg.
Yeah, but if you just look at the Eisenberg model, you can't say anything about this electron degrowth.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so what I want to say is that this. So look, if you don't want to, this was called. This is the symmetry that they actually talked about. Okay, it's not. Okay, so anyway, what I want to say is that if you're looking at a model which only has the lower Hubbard band, and you're asking, and the broadening of this Hubbard band is entirely due to these incoherent processes. A valid description of the original system will be valid entirely in the lower Hubbard band if, in fact, the broadening is less than the charge gap. So what's the largest broadening that you can have? Well, it's just the number of sites times the hopping that has to do with the broadening, which means the actual physical constraint that you have to impose for the TJ description to be valid is that there's no broadening in the lower Hubbard band that has to do with double occupancy, which means this constraint has to be true, which means that, in fact, the U and L, the system size going to infinity, in fact, do not commute. Okay. So if, in fact, you were to do an integration rather than projection, supposedly this problem would not arise. And
T times the number of sites is a worst case scenario, right?
That is the, yeah, but that is the, that's the largest possible energy that you could have.
But it
okay.
Could be much less than
it could be much less than that.
In which case, the TJ completely combined, right?
Well,
so wait a second. You're saying T times the number of sites hits the charge gap. That means I can build excitations.
Right.
But if that excitation is n, if T is much smaller than U, and so n would have to be some very large thing for T times n to be of order U, that excitation, so let's say n is 100, that excitation would be 100 electrons in the lower band.
Right.
Kinetic energy.
But
the matrix element to turn into one electron in the upper Hubbard band is probably very small.
That's right.
So why should that work?
Technically, that is the constraint that has to be imposed. Okay? And the reason why I say, so in the worst case scenario, n is on the order of the system size if, After n excursions, you haven't encountered a double occupancy. Okay. Anyway, okay. So what I'm going to
very high order.
Right. Fine, but technically that is the constraint. Okay. Okay. So I don't want to pursue this path of changing the statistics of the particles. The only other way of, in fact, preserving this 2x rule, namely that when you remove an electron, two states, in fact, are created right above the upper Hubbard band, or you add an electron, two straight states are destroyed. You have to generate new degrees of freedom at low energy. Okay, and one way that might play out is the following: what if, when you integrate out the high energy scale, there is an effective new particle left over? And this binds to the hole which was left over to create a new charge E excitation. So this is now the coupling constant to the high energy degrees of freedom. This part right here is the remnant of the high energy. And if this forms a new bound state, then it is the case that an electron is really in a linear superposition of these two states. And hence, eliminating an electron would correspond to the annihilation then of two states, and hence preserve the 2x sum rule. Okay, that new degrees of freedom are needed because the number of charges that you haven't, that you've removed is not equal to the number of states in your spectral weight. Okay, so the fact that this requires new degrees of freedom was actually noticed a long time ago when George wrote this very nice paper on spectral weight transfer. And he says, in this sense, it is not possible to define a Hamiltonian which describes the low-energy scale physics unless one accepts an effective non-particle conservation. So what he's saying is that there have to be new degrees of freedom, which in fact are interchanging with the charge degrees of freedom that you nominally had in the system. Okay, now what I want to show you is how that comes about. Okay, so the key idea is to extend the Hilbert space of the Hubbard model and introduce a new fermionic oscillator which has occupancy, this is fermionic, 1 or 0 on every site. And the goal is to try to coarse-grain cleanly the energy in this problem, to coarse-grain cleanly on the energy scale U, so that this new field is identified with the upper Hubbard band physics. Now I'm going to impose a constraint so that all the unphysical states are removed. And in fact, if I go, so I'm going to impose a constraint such that this new oscillator is associated with the creation of double occupancy. If I go and solve this constraint, and I organize my Lagrangian accordingly in this extended space so that I get back the Hubbard model, this would just be a fancy representation of the Hubbard model. But what I really want to do, since this represents the high energy physics in the problem, is not go and solve the constraint, but integrate over this new field D. And once I integrate over this new field D, I'll have the low energy theory of the Hubbard model. Okay, so let me show you how this works. Okay, so what I extend the Hilbert space of the Hubbard model by introducing this new oscillator D. And on every site then, I have the standard states associated with the fermionic operator C up and C down, as well as this new oscillator D. Okay? So there are some unphysical states in this system. For example, this is an unphysical state. This is an unphysical one, and this is an unphysical state. Okay?
Is it a boson or a fermion? The operator.
Matthew, you're not paying attention. Okay. No, it's a fermion. It's a fermion.
Charged to a boson somewhere.
You'll see how that comes about. Okay? D is a fundamental fermionic field, which I'm going to associate with the upper Hubbard band. Okay?
Doubly occupied state is associated with this.
I'm going to introduce a constraint such that this fermionic oscillator D is associated with the creation of double occupancy. Now, I know what you're thinking. How are you going to do that? Because, I'll show you how you do this. Well, no, it's a standard question, right? I mean, this double occupant transforms is a boson. How are you actually going to do this? Fine. Okay? Okay. So anyway, there are several unphysical states in this system, okay? And what we're going to do as a result of the constraint is show that all of these unphysical states are, in fact, removed. Okay? Now what you have to do is write down a Lagrangian in this extended space so that you preserve all of the hops that you had in the Hubbard model. Okay? So here's the Lagrangian that does this for you. Okay, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, I'll tell you what this is in a minute. So you have the dynamics. Now we're integrating out the upper Hubbard band, so we only have dynamics of charges now in the lower Hubbard band. So this is the dynamical term for the lower Hubbard band. And we also have dynamics associated with this D operator. Okay, now supposedly we have coarse-grained this system, so D will enter as just It's just replacing what you had for the Hubbard model, so its coupling constant will in fact be U. Okay? Then you have the standard Hopping term in the lower Hubbard band, and these are these constraint operators right here for the lower Hubbard band. And then you have all of the Hopping processes then for this new oscillator D. So this is the term which is this one right here. Since since we've introduced an elemental field D having to do with two electron physics, it can decay into an electron on two different sites, and that's this one right here. Okay, and then it can also you can have two different sites, and just this operator D can decay into fashion. Okay, so these are all of the Hopping processes that are necessary to coarse grain at the energy scale U and make sure that D is associated with the creation of double occupancy. Now that is associated with the creation of double occupancy we get by exponentiating a delta function, and we have a constraint, and the constraint looks like this. Okay? Now because D is fermionic and double occupancy transforms as a boson, we have to refermionize double occupancy. That you can do with the Grassmann variable, and the eta represents a Grassmann variable. And the partition function is written, the Lagrangian is written in a funny way as an integration over these Grassmann variables. Okay?
So is it correct statement that this Lagrangian gives after integrating out all the other auxiliary fields back to the original Hubbard model? That's the statement we should...
Let me, I'll come to that in a minute before I... let me first tell you, you are right, but let me first tell you what everything else is. Okay? Now, what you should be remembering is the nonlinear sigma model. Okay, when you have the nonlinear sigma model, you have a constraint on the length of your scalar field, you introduce a constraint, and there's an auxiliary field which comes in, namely sigma. Okay? We've done the same thing here. D we want to treat as the elemental field, and we introduce a Lagrange multiplier now associated with this constraint. That Lagrange multiplier is phi, but it's actually eta bar times phi, because it also has to be fermionic. Okay? But we write it in this fashion, separating out this Grassmann variable from this, and this is the charge 2b boson, which will appear later on in the theory. Okay?
So, is it obvious that you want to make this new particle d fermionic? Because there was some boson fermion models for the cuprates that pretty much do the same except with fewer particles.
Those models are entirely phenomenological and are not derived from the Hubbard model.
And you can sort of parameterize the Hubbard model in a similar way, right? By calling it doubly occupied site of boson and then introducing some infinite repulsion or something.
That does not allow you to cleanly identify the physics on the energy scale U. Okay? This allows us to do that because D is just an elemental fermionic field.
Well, then you can have a bosonic field that's also elemental.
If you were going to make D, the reason why it's easier this way is that we have D is now restricted to single occupancy. Okay? If you wanted to go and do that, you would have to either introduce some infinite repulsion or have some funny sort of constraint. This is the simplest way of doing it.
Okay, so now I understand the motivation.
Yeah, this is the simplest way of doing it.
Like hardcore charge to his boson to try to cook up in a way.
Yeah. Well, we're not trying to cook it up. We're trying to integrate out this energy scale, and in so doing, an auxiliary field appears in the theory. Okay? Okay, so this, as I said, is a Grassmann integration. And V sigma is 1 if the spin is up, minus 1 when the spin is down. So this decay is into the singlet channel. And this thing is just this thing right here. Okay? Okay. So this is my starting Lagrangian for this problem. Okay. Now what I do is I go and solve the constraint. Okay? So I integrate over phi, integrate over D. The integral over phi simply gives you this. go and make the substitution everywhere in this Lagrangian, and you end up with all of the Grassmann factors coming out in front, and you're just left with the Lagrangian of the Hubbard model. This is just unity. So all of the Grassmann stuff that I introduced was just a fancy way of inserting unity. So to answer your question, up to a fancy way of inserting unity, this is the Hubbard model. Okay? Okay. So that much is clear. You can actually go and it's very easy to go and check all of this. Okay. So the UV theory then is exactly the Hubbard model. But the nice thing about this is we've done what we set out to do. We've associated then with the physics on the energy scale U an elemental field D, which is entirely fermionic, and we can just go and do a fermionic path integral. And in fact, you can do it exactly, because the theory is entirely Gaussian in D. Yes?
Sort of a naive technical question. I'm used to writing down a bosonic field as a constraint and multiplying it by a bosonic field and saying I get a delta function. Here you're multiplying that bosonic field by some product of Grassmannian fields and then saying that again gives a delta function and I can make the substitution. Is that always correct? I mean, I remember
this is,
on the Efetov approach for these, they do similar things and there's a lot of theory.
There's absolutely no technical problem here. Okay? There's absolutely none. This is a standard trick in supersymmetry. Okay?
So it is correct in
this. Yeah, case. It's absolutely correct. Okay? It's absolutely correct. Okay, so as I said, we've accomplished what we want to do because we've written down the Hubbard model in a way in which the energy scale D is just associated with this elemental field D, and we can integrate over it exactly. And in so doing, we will have the low energy theory of the Hubbard model. Okay, so this is the exact low energy theory. Okay, it's somewhat complicated, but as you see, there's going to be a determinant of a matrix that comes from these fermions, and that's just what this is. The rest of the terms just come from going and completing the square, which is the major part of the problem. And so this is a constraint hopping that you normally get in the TJ model. And here are a bunch of terms. But note, the theory now depends on this new field phi. Okay? That's the magic. All the eta factors, when you go and integrate over D, factor out in front, and you just end up with integral D squared eta, eta bar eta, which is unity. Okay, so all of this fancy manipulating these Grassmanns doesn't affect the theory either in the UV or in the IR. It's really just a tool to keep track of the statistics, and it just comes up being one. Okay, and this matrix just looks like this, and here, of course, the inverse of this thing appears. Okay, and B is just a singlet operator on neighboring sites, and one can easily generalize this to any kind of hopping you want by just changing the structure of this matrix GIJ. Okay. Now, notice, in introducing the constraint, this is just a technical point, I just wanted to make sure. Since this constraint is entering the Lagrangian, it has to have units of energy, this normalization is actually carried in the field phi. So I could have absorbed this into this, but that would have changed its commutation relation, so I've just kept this factor out in front. And this appears everywhere in the theory.
It's a phi is a canonical boson.
Right. Okay, so, and that's this S squared factor. Every place you see phi, there will be an S associated with it.
What is S again?
Okay, so now the question is, what is S? Okay, so which is why I put this out in front so that We can then talk about what are the sorts of physical regimes that arise by different normalizations for S. Okay, one choice is that S is U. Okay? If S is of order U, then this term is of order U, and in fact what we should do immediately, since phi would also be associated with heavy degrees of freedom, is just go and integrate out phi immediately.
Sorry, which is early, just on the previous slide. I mean, your full Lagrangian, which was exact, I mean, I assume there was a d dagger d tau d term, and that would.
So here's the Lagrangian.
You end up with a some non-locality. I don't see how you get to a Hamiltonian.
Right. Okay. So it's the standard thing you do. I mean, there will be a frequency dependence that comes here, okay? And what we've done is we've just expanded out the T over omega plus U and just taken the omega equals zero limit.
Well, it's not exact then. I mean, you know, we've got those terms, which are... Yeah, then there'll be, you know, it's like a temporal gradient.
Right, yeah, temporal, right. Right, but you can retain it. It's just then you couldn't define a Hamiltonian. But
sure.
But if you start with a Lagrangian, you always face that problem.
So is it the Lattrace?
No. What the question Matthew is arguing is that here every U should be omega plus U. Okay, so we're assuming that U is much bigger than omega, so which is why this is a low energy theory.
Yeah, you could, as you say, keep correction.
Right. But no.
You get new commutation right into your operator.
Right. Okay. So that is the theory. Okay. So what is S? Okay. Then you should just go and integrate out phi. This is entirely reversible. Okay. If you just take this theory right here, integrate out phi, you get back with the Hubbard model. Okay. So this theory encodes all of the high energy scales in it.
You said it's not exact, so you can't get back to
it. What you would have to do then is, but you can only do the integration back with the Lagrangian, okay? In which case
why just not just keep the Lagrangian?
Well, because I wanted to talk about a Hamiltonian, okay? Anyway, it turns out all of our calculations were done with the Lagrangian, but, you know, we're condensed matter types, so we never talk about Lagrangians, okay? So, anyway. Okay, so anyway, you just end up back with the Hubbard model, okay? The only other choice is if S is of order T. Okay, if S is of order T, then in fact, phi does generate dynamics at low energy, and there is a true low energy limit. Okay, if you look at the terms that phi in fact generates, phi mediates, you do in fact see that it makes sense to make S of order T. So in everything I'm going to assume then that a really low energy limit does exist and phi does generate dynamics at low energy. Otherwise, I would just have the Hubbard model and there'd be nothing I could do.
Formally S is equal to U?
No, formally S is not equal to anything.
S is 1. Are you integrating over S or what?
No. S is a constant out in front of the constraint.
Where does it come from?
When you exponentiate a constraint, you have to have the correct units.
So S could be anything. It doesn't matter.
Right. S is right here. Okay, making sure you have the correct units here in your constraint. Okay.
But S has to be something in order for that to be true, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. It can be anything. Okay, that's why.
You could absorb it in the field phi, but you can't do that because
you would change
the commutation relations.
Which is why so now you're catching up to where I was, okay? I didn't want to change the commutation relations, so I wanted to keep S out in front. Okay? Now I have at the end of the day when I go and construct the IR theory, I have to set the scale S. Okay. Okay, now, one thing you can see immediately is if you go and take this theory and you take the large U limit, okay, you'll see immediately that this term, every term drops out except this one right here. And you'll just be left with this term. Okay? But remember now, this is still as a path integral over phi. If you just go and integrate over phi, you end up with just this delta function, which is no double occupancy. So the large U limit, U equals infinity, the only thing you end up with is just the constrained Hopping term, which is the correct result. Okay? There's a conserved charge if you wanted to go and do a calculation, but that's not particularly important. Okay? Now, let's look at another limit of this theory. If you just write out what B is, it's this combination here. This just generates the spin-spin interaction, okay? Which means now, and this is why I actually wanted to look at the Hamiltonian, I want to make talk about the relationship with the TJ model. Okay, so this is the constrained Hopping term in the TJ model, and now the leading term in M is just delta ij. If you ask the question, what limit does all of this go to? Well, it's just the TJ plus these terms right here. So these are all the terms which arise, which are inherently non-projective, which have to do with how the high-energy physics is playing out at low energies.
This actually does look like the boson Fermion model that I was talking about. So one gets a boson with the energy on the order of U, no?
No, this boson has an energy scale T squared over U. There are similarities, okay,
a hybridization, of course.
There is this term right here, which is not in those models. We can talk more about that, but as I said, those models are, there's no systematic way of deriving those. Okay, but
what's the difference between the second and third term? I thought BI was basically that.
This term and this?
Yeah.
BI is a singlet link on neighboring sites. BI is summed over the nearest neighbors.
Okay. So this one is on site.
This is entirely on site. Okay. So there are two contributions here, an on-site term and this term right here. Okay, so that's the theory, and we want to look at some of the consequences of it.
On-site term proportional to T? Is there any simple reason to understand that?
Yeah, there is. I'll tell you in a minute. Okay, any questions?
Before you go on, can you remind us again how to get to this Hamiltonian? What limit is that?
Okay, so what I did is I simply took the leading term. Oh, how to get this Hamiltonian or this one?
The one in yellow.
Oh, yeah, okay.
What limit is it?
So you take the Lagrangian I had, set a frequency equal to, do the expansion of one, okay, so you end up with the Hamiltonian. And then what you do is you simply truncate the M matrix at leading order. So to lead. T over U. Because M is, remember how it came in from those D dagger D terms, all of the Hopping terms in M have a coefficient T over U.
Where's S in all
those? S, I've set equal to T.
I know, but that's,
Because otherwise there is no low energy theory.
If you kept S equal to U, would you get the boson with the energy of U?
But then it wouldn't make sense to then talk about a low energy theory. Then you should go and immediately integrate over phi.
No, I understand.
In which case you'll end up back with the Hubbard model.
Makes sense or not? I'm asking what.
Right. You do. Okay. Okay.
So the short answer is an expansion T over U.
Right. Yes, that's right. So. Well, yeah, technically Matthew is correct, okay? This should be an S, that should be S times T, okay? But if you look at this, what is this term mediating? Okay, this boson term can actually mediate an exchange of spins. So it's physically, it actually makes sense that this term really is going as t squared over u. Okay, so phenomenologically then, at low energy, this choice actually makes sense.
If you put the s's back in, where would they be?
Here and here.
Yeah, so that term, I see.
So each
term, which is weird.
I know, middle term is weird.
Important to make s small.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Okay, well, let me tell you how to interpret that term. Okay, now notice this thing has this funny combination right here, okay? It's replacing this charged 2E boson with double occupancy on a site, okay? Okay. Now, so this just proves then that the true low energy theory is not the TJ model, which we knew because there is no transformation that goes from the Hubbard to the TJ. You have to go and do projection. Okay, some of this is irrelevant. Okay, you can also go and do this theory and integrate out the lower Hubbard band for the, in which you associate now this elemental field with double holes. And you can also do half filling, in which case both of these are high energy scales because they're equally far from the chemical potential. And you end up with this. Here is the theory. There is no M matrix. It's in closed form. Okay. Now, this issue then of at half filling, then you end up with these extra bosonic degrees of freedom. You don't just end up with this spin model, which has this, in my language, this local SU2, which is this particle hole type symmetry. All of these boson terms break that symmetry. Okay? Okay, now, the other reason why the boson terms are important is this thing about zeros. One can show that the single particle Green function for a Mott insulator is zero exactly on this surface right here if the system has particle hole symmetry. And important in that is showing that the real part of the Green function vanishes. Okay, if you were to in fact do projection, which would be eliminating this part, there's no way this thing would actually be zero. The phi actually retains this high energy scale, and hence you do in fact get a zero of the single particle Green function.
And if you vary the chemical potential inside the gap, it shifts it around.
It does shift it around, in which case it's no longer exactly that surface. But the important thing is that there will be a zero surface, but it might not exactly equal the Luttinger volume.
You can move the chemical energy around and scale U.
Right.
Still stay in the same phase, right? So,
right.
And presumably as you vary chemical energy on scale U, these zeros move all over the place.
Right.
I can't imagine they could even disappear.
The statement is that for a range of chemical potentials within the gap, there are zeros. Certainly, you can imagine very extreme cases in which they're not there. But my point is just very simple. If you do projection, it's a non-starter. You'll never have zeros. Fine. Okay, so now what I want to do is, so you can go and calculate the chemical potential, and you can see that there is a nice gap as a result of this bosonic degree of freedom. Well, you can even construct wave functions here, which I don't really have any time to talk about, but because it's this fermionic oscillator, if you just go and solve this condition in the UV, you end up with this nice wave function, which is pretty much similar to Gutzwiller. Okay, what I want to talk about is really what does the spectrum look like when you add and subtract electrons from the system? Okay, now to do that, I need to add a term in my Lagrangian, this should actually be Lagrangian, which generates the electron operator. And by that, I mean in this procedure of integrating over the scale D, if I integrate over D, okay, there will be a constraint coming in. If you add this term to your Lagrangian, this would actually give you the electron operator. Okay, so it's a funny term that you have to add. It has this part in the lower band plus this high energy part right here. Okay? Now, if you don't go and solve the constraint, but rather just integrate over D, what you find is that, in fact, the electron is really a linear combination of this state which you normally had, or at least the description of the electron operator in the lower Hubbard band, plus this extra piece right here. This is just a renormalization from just, you know, spin-type scattering. There is a new piece which comes from the high-energy scale. Okay? And it is the binding, and it describes a process in which you have this particle, phi, bound to a hole, if in fact this is a new bound state. Okay? So what I want then to do is reinterpret the terms in the Hamiltonian, the ones that look like phi, dagger, ci up, ci down, as a process in which you're just interchanging with a hole a particle which has charge E. And this is the new charge E particle. So what I'm going to argue is that phi is not a degree of freedom, which ultimately is a free degree of freedom. It's entirely bound, and you know about it by the structure that it gives rise to, the electron excitation spectrum. Okay, so let's assume we can go and calculate the electron spectral function in some way. And I just want to show you what the results look like. Okay, so this is what the electron spectral function looks like. So I'm looking at the maximum now in the spectral function. And notice it's fairly broad. But the important thing is that below a certain energy, below the chemical potential, the electron's spectral function splits into two pieces. There are two, essentially two dispersing states when you remove an electron. Okay? Okay, and there's one above the chemical potential. And there's a kink right here associated with this energy scale T squared over U. And there's also a kink right here once these two things split. Okay, so these are calculations that Ting Pong has done. And this also persists at large values of U, and it disappears as you as you dope the system to the overdope regime. Okay, so a characteristic then of this system seems to be that we have these two parts to it. And this branch is connected with the bound state, and this is just the standard low energy state that you had in the Hubbard model. Okay, so if you did projection, you would not be generating this state right here. Okay, so we got this result. It seems sort of weird. It's a very striking statement. We're saying that there are two charge E branches in the electron removal spectrum. Okay, so around this time, the photo emission group at Berkeley reported, in fact, that in addition to this characteristic, what they call the waterfall feature, if you look at this far enough, there is evidence that, in fact, you have two branches in your photo emission. Okay, and the splitting here is on the order of T. And they interpreted these two branches as spin charge separation. I put forth to you that the origin of these two branches occurs naturally in the true low energy theory of the Hubbard model as just these two different charge E excitations. And they have fundamentally different dispersions, which you can calculate approximately. And they seem to be dispersing as two different modes. So this is just the standard, this should actually be a dagger standard electron. This is the other charge E excitation. So then I would argue that the charge degrees of freedom, which are relevant in the normal state of the cuprate, so you can treat as really two degrees of freedom, are this and this. Okay, so, and to reiterate, I don't think there's any free phi field around, which is why it's not correct to interpret that that one term that looked like phi dagger C up, C down as replacing phi with double occupancy. It's not doing that. Phi and C are bound, and it's just replacing that new particle F with a hole on a site. Okay. Now, if in fact phi is binding to a hole, so it's this high energy part which has come down to the chemical potential, which is creating a new state at the chemical potential. If in fact this is binds and you're subtracting states from the chemical potential, you should see a dip. We say that the pseudo gap is the formation of this bound state. Okay, and without it, you just have just a peak in the density of states. So I interpret the pseudo gap as this new bound state which arises from this high energy degree of freedom. Okay, here's just a more detailed calculation of that. The self-energy does diverge at this point, and there's a dip as you decrease the temperature. Okay, now, if in fact you have this binding in the pseudo gap state, how does that, can you somehow say anything about T linear resistivity? I think you can. Now, several years ago, I showed with Claudio Shimone that if you adopt three simple assumptions, that you have just standard one-parameter scaling, the charges are the critical degrees of freedom, and you have charge conservation, there's no way that quantum criticality can give you linear T resistivity. We derive the general form for the conductivity, and it looks like this. And the only way you can get, assuming D is 3, that you can get a conductivity, which is scaling as 1 over T here, is if, in fact, Z is negative, which is impossible. Except, of course, in certain non-commutative theories, which is why Rob and I started working on this problem, which turned out to be unnecessary. There is no non-commutative theory here, okay? Okay, but what I'm trying to say is that the standard scenario for T-linear resistivity within quantum criticality doesn't work unless there's some other stuff going on. Okay, so what I want to do is tell you now what the new scenario is of how this binding of C and phi can give you T-linear resistivity. So this bound state sits down here at some energy below the chemical potential. Okay, and let's assume, and as you dope the system, the chemical potential moves down. Okay, once it moves down, you essentially have no energy scale, no energy gap to create a boson, which means, in fact, this thing is now going to unbind. Okay, so let's assume that there's some critical value of the doping at which that happens. If there's some critical value, this energy has now gone to zero. And let's say the dominant scattering in a certain range of, in a certain TX window here, is still governed by the scattering of the holes with this boson. But you're at a temperature now, since the boson energy has gone to zero, in which the temperature is the biggest energy scale in the problem. Well, we all know what the answer is. If you have scattering of bosons with electrons, when the energy to create the boson is bigger than the energy in which the temperature is bigger than the energy to create the boson, you always end up with T linear resistivity. Okay? So I would argue then crossing this line is a binding transition, and I'm not sure it's really a transition, but there's a bound state that is here. And this is liberated in this, and it's the boson which is scattering off of the fermions, giving rise to T-linear resistivity. Okay, there are other things you can look at. Optical conductivity. Another curious feature of the cuprates is this mid-infrared band. You, of course, have a Drudeb weight, but the mid-infrared band is sort of anomalous because you wouldn't expect any sort of absorption in a Mott insulator at these sorts of frequencies. you would expect something here or something way up there at the in the upper Hubbard band. Okay, we've analyzed this as well, and what seems to be the case is that this mid-infrared is sitting right at the energy where you're converting this new particle into a hole, in which case I'd argue that this mid-infrared band is representing the energy of this new bound state. Okay, I think that's about, I mean, I have other stuff I could talk about, but I think I probably have talked long enough. Let me just say one last thing. Okay, let me not say this. Let me just summarize. Okay, yeah, actually, we have a prediction. Okay, we have a prediction. Okay, and this is something George might find of interest. Since we have these two dispersing modes, these two different charge E modes, they should show up in the dielectric function, in the inverse dielectric function, the imaginary part of it. And we would argue then that there should be two dispersing particle hole modes in the dielectric function, one the standard one that you see for electrons in the lower Hubbard band, and then another one which would terminate at momenta once you cross the Fermi momentum. And the weight here is, as if you're in an F sum rule, the weight here is as large as the weight here. Now, there are many theories that give you extra peaks in the imaginary part of the dielectric function, like stripes. But this weight is significant and pretty much equal to this weight here. All of the other ones give you a tiny amount of weight over here. Okay? So we would argue that if you do an Eales experiment and you see two dispersing particle hole modes, that is evidence, in fact, that these two charged E states really do exist. Okay, so what I did is I started with the Hubbard model. I integrated out the high energy scale, and the electron seems to be a composite entity, which has a standard low energy part, which looks like the standard thing in the lower Hubbard band, plus this new component, which is coming from the high energy. It seems to be mediating, I think, the physics associated with the strange metal and the pseudo-gap phase, as well as the mid-infrared. Okay, so I just want to thank my collaborators, Rob Lee again, and Ting-Pong Choi. Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. So there is a local version of the Hubbard model called the Anderson model.
Right.
Presumably, very similar manipulations.
We've done that in the longer paper. Okay, the longer paper, we did every possible U model and we've shown that this machinery. Yeah, and you have the...
So the Anderson model is integrable, so you have exact statements which you can compare to.
Right.
So this manipulation, so integrate out with high degrees of high energy degrees of freedom, some effective low energy theory which you could in principle...
So what we are trying to do right now is compare the excitation spectrum we think we're getting here with the 1D Hubbard model, which is also integrable, and of course the Anderson model. And that's in fact what I'm supposed to be doing here, as well as trying to figure out how these things pair up to give rise to superconductivity. But absolutely, that's, since what we did is exact, I mean, it should show up in beta ansatz, precisely how that's what we're trying to figure out.
In your approach, though, the end result is one in which, if I would look, so you have your electrons split up, or it's composed of two pieces, mm-hmm. Where one piece lives on the low energy scale, the other piece lives on a higher energy scale. Actually, if I think about
of
two states, shall we say, but that high energy scale that you have is much lower than the U energy.
Oh yeah, it's transferred down, right.
That's the thing that is somewhat different from an ordinary projection, where the wave function of an added electron would have a component in the lower Hubbard band, a component in the upper Hubbard band, and that is what actually gives you this dynamic spectral wave transfer. It's just the phases of those wave functions compared to the phase in the ground state that give you this this dynamic spectral wave transfer. But that's a much bigger energy scale.
Right. But there should still be the same thing here, because you have
this. It's the same thing. I don't really follow as to why that energy scale would be way down there.
Well, you've done a low energy theory.
I know you have, but the point, but is it because you've done a low energy theory, which means that you can't say anything about the high energy scale, or?
Certainly, physics on the energy scale T is in the model, okay? And remember now, the matrix element to convert on-site this new state EH into a whole is T. Okay, and that we claim gives rise to the mid-infrared.
So maybe you can, do you have a physical feeling for what the higher energy branch in imaginary part of 1 over epsilon is?
Okay, so.
So you have the two branches.
Right. Okay, so I.
Do you have a physical feeling for what that higher energy?
I have a physical feel for that, but not from this theory, because we can't say anything about it from this theory. But, you know, I've done all these calculations on the Hubbard model, and so I certainly have some idea what they are. But within this theory, you're restricted to an energy range, certainly below the chemical potential, basically T above. So I can't really say anything on the energy scale U.
But showing your electron energy loss features, they were of energy T, right?
Right.
So, can you tell me what that? Can you say something about that particular?
This right here?
Yes.
Yeah.
As to where that really comes from, the physics of it.
Right. This I would say is this. It's the physics of the mid infrared.
No, that's, but then you haven't told me what.
But no. Okay. So okay. I told you. Okay. So this is the binding of this hole to this new boson. Creating
the boson. I mean, the boson is a double
occupant. No, the boson. Look, Matthew, the boson is not.
High energies, but maybe it's not a very strong. Yeah. It must have a very strong attractive interaction with a C.
It would bring it all the way down. If S were U, then that would be the case.
Yeah. I mean,
but that's not.
That's not the case. Yeah. Or does it come from, for example, the case where an electron sitting next to a doubly occupied site has a different dynamics moving away from that site even than an electron which is not in the vicinity of a doubly occupied site? And that's simply because as soon as it moves away, one of the other electrons pop in. And those are the kind of things that are really important.
Yes. That's what this is.
That's the kind of physics.
Okay. It's the fact that a hole is not just an empty state.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? It's a heavily dressed state. And it's dressing because of the high energy physics, and that's what phi is doing.
How did you know that you should take S equal to T and not say root of E and U or something?
Okay, so as I said, once if you look at the processes that are in the Hamiltonian, there's this term that goes as ST over U, phi dagger BI. Okay, that term can interchange the position of two electrons. Okay? Given that, it's a spin exchange term, and hence its energy scale should really be T squared over U. And it's even on phenomenological grounds, it seems as if S should be T.
I don't know. It seemed to me that, like, taking S equal to U was the natural choice. I'm giving an argument that there are two natural choices.
Well, there are only two energy scales in the problem.
But if there are two, then I can make any number of them, right?
Well, you can make two choices. So if S is of order U, then you have to integrate over phi. In which case, there is no low energy theory of the Hubbard model.
No, the TJ model.
No, there isn't even that. That's not the low energy theory of the Hubbard model, okay? That's a projected model which doesn't live in the same Hilbert space as any of the eigenstates of the Hubbard model live in. Okay?
Suppose S were twice T. Wouldn't the final result change?
Okay, that's not a question. Okay.
I think it's a good question.
Okay.
What would happen?
Nothing would happen. There'd just be an extra two around. Yeah.
It would change quantitatively.
Yeah, it would change quantitatively, but.
So why did you choose the fitting parameter to the one-dimensional Hubbard model?
Well, ultimately, well, you know, Matthew, as I said, one of the things I'm supposed to be doing here is matching this excitation spectrum with, you know.
I know, but which value of S are you going to take when you try to do that?
Okay. I don't know yet. I haven't done it.
It will affect the excitation spectrum, right?
It certainly will affect the excitation spectrum.
Make a choice, or, you know, use it as a, you know, variational parameter somehow. You know,
right. Look. So what I've done is I've told you what it has to be on the order of for a low energy theory to exist. Beyond that, I can't make any statement.
Well, in order for your low energy derivation.
Well, this is
your derivation of a low energy theory to be correct.
Well, no, because I claim, Matthew, since we've cleanly identified the physics on the energy scale U, we've solved the problem. I don't see any other Lagrangian that can accomplish this. It would have to be identical to what we've done.
But if there's real physics in here, you've got to be able to tell us where S is coming from and what its magnitude should be.
Right. Well, as I said, I mean, if you look at the terms it mediates, physical processes that phi can mediate, it seems reasonable that S is of order T, because it can mediate spin exchange.
Okay, I suggest that we end this talk and let people continue outside of this thing.